Session number 29811, Reel 2.
A pastor boy, see, we used to have Chinese servants to polish our boots and uniforms and brasses, even look after our rifles. they were very good. They became good friends, these Chinese boys. This one was called Arfat. And we passed him, and he was standing by the roadside with all these other Chinese, and he was weeping his heart out, because he's seen his friends and his livelihood going. Anyhow, we carried on walking up the hill, down there, and we passed this bridge going over that ravine, and made of steel, a big steel. In the end, this girders were big, and the end hadn't been filled in. It was still open, about that wide, about 3 foot high, and there was an Indian there. He'd taken refuge in there and died there, and he stuck in it, like, half crouched down, and he was dead. And his skin was turning blue with death, you see. Anyhow, we finished up at, I forget what it's called, White Point or something. He put us in a camp there, the first camp. That was awful. And all they gave us to eat was some fat, pieces of fat floating about on greasy water with a little bit of rice. And we learned then, from then on, that we're going to be on bare rations, you know. And then the next couple of days, the masters to the ferry took us across the ferry to Nathan Road in the Kowloon. They made us march down Nathan Road. The Chinese were all lining the road to Sham Shui Po. Sham Shui Po was a Middlesex, and I think the Royal Scots and Middlesex, a huge barrack block. Big barrack block on one side, then this the harbour water, and then there were lots of big nissenuts in there. The rest of the ground, and he took us in this, put us in this big barrack block, a lot of shell holes. You could look down through the hole in our wall into down below, shot below. And we fed us just rice and soup, watered rice and soup. We realized then that there's going to be a lot of trouble health-wise sooner or later. And one night we looked down the hole, and there were two Chinese young fellas down there, and they'd been in the Hong Kong Volunteers Army, you see, because they asked for volunteers to help fight the Japanese. But 100,000 volunteers wouldn't have kept the Japanese out. Anyhow, and they had a black dog in this sink, the old-fashioned sink, like you see in most farmhouses. And they're pouring hot water on and scraping the fur off it. And all night this little beautiful smell had come up through the hole, shell hole, bisto, you know. The next morning, a knock on the door, and there were three of us in this room, in this small room. And he said, "You want tea some?" So he gave us this big bowl, and it was full of cooked dog meat, and the gravy was top nice and golden. And of course we looked at him and said, "Oh, we're Englishmen, we don't eat dogs." Anyhow, I tried it first, and within 5 minutes it was all gone. You can't taste the difference between dog and rabbit or beef when you're hungry, you know. Yeah. But we learned so many lessons there the hard way. You know, there were some that demeaned themselves. They would follow the Japanese around waiting for the dog end of the fag cigarette to be dropped. They demeaned themselves in the Japanese eyes. The Japanese should love to see them do that, you know. But there's some awful things happened there. We had a diphtheria epidemic. And diphtheria epidemic it closes the throat. You can't breathe. And they wouldn't give us any drugs. So the chaps just had to choke to death and die. And then there was another epidemic, which I think was just as worse, if not worse. It was amoebic dysentery. And he had a very good friend in my barrack. He's one of the chaps in my barrack room in peacetime. He was called Thomas. We used to call him Tomo. And he had a premonition. If he went in there, he'd never come out. And one day I missed him. I said, "Where's Tomo?" "He's gone." "Oh, he's got that. He's got dysentery." And I knew the chap that was called a doctor. We had no medicines and nothing. We just sat in an office and tried to help the lads the best he could. I went in and I said, "Excuse me, sir." I said, "Can I go and see Tomo?" He said, "Well, I know you, Shepherd. He's our MO at the barracks, Stanley." Stanley bags. And all right, Shep, he said, don't stay very long, it's very contagious, and you won't like what you see. And poor old Tom was lying in bed, and the only bed he had was lying on the springs, you know, the old springs. There was no mattress. And there was straw on top of that. The straw bit under the bed to catch the blood was flowing from his body. And there's blood all over the place. And poor old Tomo, his head was hanging over the side of the bed like it didn't belong to him. And just then, the kid had taken him away. Of course, he'd taken him away to die, you know. Poor old Tomo, he had a premonition and it came to pass, you know. I used to walk around the wire and say, can I escape from here? I'll go back to White Chow or somewhere like that. And I thought, well, the penalty for escaping is he shoot you. I thought, well, no good dead, am I? So I didn't try to escape. There's one or two who got away with it. They had a Red Cross party from Switzerland or somewhere. I visited the camp. And they had a Red Cross on the arm, the band. And this chap, I forget what regiment he was in, not the artillery, I think it was the engineers or something like that, or the signals. He got the idea, he made an armband with the Red Cross, and he escaped. He got back to England. And I thought, why didn't I think of that? Anyhow, the time came, they said, we want somebody to go to Japan to work on the docks. And I thought, well, it can't be any worse than this. I wouldn't have lived, I wouldn't have survived if I'd stayed there. Because they got up to unearthly hours to parade on the parade ground, you're standing there for hours in the sunshine, you know. I thought to myself, well, it can't be any worse than this, so. Anyhow, I volunteered to go on the Lisbon Maru. We filed on board the Lisbon Maru. There was 1,802 of us on board. And the ship, right at the very bottom where the ballast was, the prisoners down there, they were terrible condition down there at the bottom of the ship. And then there's another deck where that wasn't so bad. And then I was what they called tween decks. Below the bridge, there's a small hold below the bridge. Steel door from the ship, from the bridge, which opens into this small captain's cabin. Then down below, there's this small. And they put us in there. Now that was about 7 foot, 8 foot high. And what they'd done, they'd build a platform to make it 3 foot 6 or 4 foot high, so it could get two lots of prisoners, but you couldn't stand up. You just crammed us in. But the rest of the prisoners, those poor souls down there, we used to take us up to the toilet, which was a wooden structure hanging over the side of the ship. If it ever given way, we'd have finished up in the ocean, the Pacific. We used to take us up once a day to do our business. And I was just going down, and this old friend of mine, Bill Page, he's a lovely man, corporal in the artillery. He worked in the offices in Stanley, an office worker. And I said, how are you getting on, Bill? He says, well, Albert, he said, I've just been told by the doctor couldn't give any medicine, just give advice. He said, I've got diphtheria. And he told me the only advice I can give you, William, is to go down and say nothing to anybody, otherwise there'll be panic. And that's the last I saw of Bill. We were sailing along through the Pacific, no land in sight, and all of a sudden, woof, woof, two torpedoes into the ship. And just scurrying about like they do in panic, they panic, like Sergeant Jones in Dad's Army. Don't panic. And they lowered a little pump down with a kitchen out, never mind a ship hold. And we were laboring with this thing, and it was still rising up. Of course, one of the officers had a piece of cane, he put it down. And anyhow, we felt the ship going over. It was going down, and then it went over slightly. And I was in the line to pump this little pump, and the chap in front of me, he fainted because the air was pretty stale. So me and one of my mates, we picked him up, head and tail, And there were steps going up to the captain's cabin. We got the top of the steps, and there was a landing, a little landing there. And just as we got on the landing, the ship went over inside, and the water came through the porthole down to where my mates were. Well, they'd get out of that quick. Anyhow, we hadn't been in this captain's cabin, if it was a cabin, I don't know, very long before we heard shots fired. And shouting and shouting, and I thought, what's going on? Anyhow, in one of the holds, you know what the ship, when it's battened down, they put a tarpaulin, a heavy tarpaulin over, and then they put ropes over to keep the storm water out of to keep the goods dry. Well, that's what they'd done. They'd battened everything down, hoping to sink the ships with everybody on it. But there was a chap there, he always carried a butcher's knife. How he got away with it, I don't know. He had it down inside his leg. And he carried this butcher's knife, and he slid it between the bars, and he cut the rope. And that corner of the hold, they pushed it through, and he came out. Well, the first few were wounded, but the guards on the bridge, half a dozen guards on the bridge, but the rest pushed, and he came out in a flood. They threw the Japanese guards in the water, in the Pacific. And then somebody opened the door, the steel door, into our prison. And thank the Lord, we got out onto the deck, and she was sloping down like that then, you know. And the lads were on the deck, some couldn't swim, so they just sat there. But those that could dived off. And I thought, what the hell can I do now? And just before I left Hong Kong, a few months before I left Hong Kong, before the Japanese came out, taught me how to swim in Stanley Bay. So I went down side of the ship on my hunkers, you see, slid down into the water, and there was about three or four Japanese landing craft surrounding the ship, 200 or 300 yards away. And I swam towards one, and as I was about halfway there, I could only do the side stroke, it's the only one I knew. But it kept me afloat. And I got halfway across, and they started shooting at us in the water, bing, 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 you know, using for target practice. So I swam back to the ship. And I got back to the ship, and there was a whirlpool. You know when a ship goes down, it forms a whirlpool. And I was dragged towards this whirlpool, and then there was a piece of rope hanging down. I grabbed the piece of rope, because that stopped me going down. And then just then, a Carly raft about 6 foot square came by, and I grabbed hold of the raft and let go of the rope, and it flung too big to go down the whirlpool. It just flung us out into the Pacific, you see. And I don't know how long we're floating in the Pacific. We kept getting farther and farther away from the ship. And the chap on the other side, we couldn't have the strength to climb on board. We were just hanging onto the ropes. And I noticed his eyes glazed over, like a little film came over his eye. And his hands just let go like that. Let go of the rope, and he just went down. He just died or gone unconscious, and he just died. We drifted out into the ocean, and we saw this tugboat coming towards us. And it was the Japanese Navy. Now, the Japanese Navy, I believe, were partly trained by the British Navy, the turn of the century, 1800s, 1900. And they were friendly toward the British. But the army was just the opposite. They looked up to Hitler. So, got picked up. Chance in a million. As I was sailing away from the wreck to Shanghai, as it was going down, all I saw of the ship was about 10 feet of the main mast sticking above the water. And clinging to the mast was one man with both arms wrapped round the mast. I've often wondered, even to this day, who he was. The poor soul couldn't swim. You know, it doesn't haunt me, but it sticks in my mind. I never go to bed without thinking about these things that happened on the Lisbon Maru and in Japan and in Shamshipo. It sticks with me all the time. I can't get rid of it. But that's a little memory that I've always remembered, that this poor old, only young man clinging to the masses, waiting for it to go down.
It's horrible.
and we took us to Shanghai. He took us on to the Bund, the great big area where they stuck all the goods at the side of the harbour. And they stood us all there. Most of the lads were stone naked. They didn't have any clothes at all. They'd been washed off. I had a little tiny pair of shorts on. You know, I was well dressed. Anyhow, our diarrhea was swelling seawater. I said to the Japanese guard standing, I said, I want to go to Benjo. Well, Benjo means toilet in Japanese, Benjo. And he screamed at me, do it there where you're standing. So I just put my pants down, did it, and pulled them up again. Couldn't wipe your bottom. And then it took us somewhere to an old ship. It was so old it had no bulkheads. I said, if this one gets torpedoed, it'll go straight to the bottom. And we had pumpkin soup, and I've never tasted anything so nice. Pumpkin soup. There must have been a lot of pumpkins in that part of China at the time, in Shanghai. And we finished up in Kobe. Kobe was a beautiful city, a beautiful town road, where the houses were all the old Chinese bungalow type. The wood was hundreds of years old, dark. All that extended families living in them, you know. And I like the Japanese people as a people, but the military were they were awful. They were different to the Japanese ordinary folks. He used to talk to the dockers on the docks, and was to work and just look around, and say nobody looking, and say censor, that's war, censor piggy, no good sense, war's no good. You see? And when we landed at this huge warehouse, it was an old butter built by an export-import firm, a British called Butterfield and Swire. I'm not quite sure whether they're still working now, but it was a huge, well, we used to put liquor and tobacco and things that they didn't want the Japanese to use, iron bars at the window, and a great big iron, thick half-inch iron door, massive big thing. And they'd built inside, ripped all the insides out, and they'd built 1, 2, 3, 4 platforms about 20 inches high and about 6 foot 6 wide. The whole length, 4 of them, and we slept on that. And we slept on hard boards for 4 years. Hard boards. Now I've got a bed so soft. Hard boards for 4 years. And I was one of the first men to go in, and we were a bed ragged a lot because we'd just come off a shipwreck. And we were marched through the streets of Kobe. The people just thought, these are British prisoners of war. They're a poor looking lot, you know. And I remember whenever we went into this place, I was one of the first to go in. You could smell new wood and tatami matting about very thin. And I remember an officer, I think he was I'm not quite sure whether he was a CO of the Middlesex or the Royal Scots. He's called Monkey Stewart. But the lads called him Monkey because he had a limp. I think I don't know why he got in the First World War or what. But they used to worship the man, Monkey Stewart. And I heard him say to the Japanese interpreter, the Japanese officers, it was bloody premeditated mass murder. I remember saying that as if it was, he said it last night. He shouted to the Japanese interpreter, the Japanese, with premeditated mass murder. Of course, he didn't hear the reply in Japanese, of course, but anyhow, they took the officers away, the senior officers, and put them on an island called Shikoku, out in the bay, Kobe Bay. And Kobe Harbour, the most wonderful harbour in the world. And it all lined with warehouses. And we used to work on the warehouses, unloading ships and barges. And believe you me, when you got that first sack on your shoulder, your knees buckled. Because they were at least 100 weight, they were fairly light, 100 weight and a half. And you just stagger up this plank, and to stack them up, the Chinese, Japanese would be there with hooks, stacking them up into 30 foot high. But after a while, we got used to it, you know. And we became as good as the Japanese stevedores, you see. And they used to have a song that they used to sing when they were swinging the sacks about the oven. I dig a dig, I dig a dig, dog guy naughty, I dig a dig. And some of our lads used to say, I dig it, told you, number one jai night, Churchill number 10 jai night. The Japanese twigged it. The Stevie would say, oh no, told you, number 10, Churchill number one. But we became friends with them. Got the young people had all gone to war. The old people still had this tight thing round the belly and a scarf round the head with Japanese leaping on. But what was our salvation, or my salvation, but the work chaps I worked with, who worked on this firm called Kamigumi. It's still going now. Kamigumi was a very big firm. They had vast warehouses. And one of the things we used to unload for months on end was peanuts. You see, the Japanese had taken Manchuria, renamed it Manchukuo. Well, it was the sort of area where you can grow peanuts and barley and wheat and stuff, great. And they robbed all the thousands of tons of peanuts, and we unloaded them. And we used to be eating them all day. They couldn't stop us, because the bags were all rotten. We used to be trails of peanuts all the way up, lying on the floor. They didn't use them as food, they used them for soap and oil. But anyhow, that's what brought me home, peanuts. You can live on peanuts. Believe you me, you can't. Live on peanuts. There's other firms. There's another firm called Higashinada, which was a railway station on the outskirts. We used to unload trucks of coal from there. Trucks of coal from Higashinada. And it was quite a friendly, easygoing. But there's one guard, and the guard was usually, he was so old that you could have knocked him over with your finger, but he still had a rifle in the bender. And while we were in Gagashidara one day, we looked up, we just finished unloading this big trucks of coal, waiting for the next one to come, and we heard this plane. I'm jumping ahead now, it's 1945, spring of 45, we heard this drone in the sky. The Japanese start running about screaming, B-N-U-Q, B-N-U-Q. Well, B-N-U-Q come in B-29. And this huge four vapor trail, beautiful, oh, gorgeous. All on its own. The Japanese Air Force had given up the air, nothing. And they went, and they turned left, and covered the whole of Kobe. And my mate said he'd taken photographs. And he did. He came back about 3 months later, and he plastered Kobe. He plastered it. You could smell the peanuts and the rice that took burning for miles. And they stopped at our camp. He said, hey, we must know we're here. We must know where we are. We came back a month later and where they'd finished last time they started. And the first to go was our camp. 2 hours, it was gone. Thick bricks. It was gone. There was another firm. They used to make graphite. You know, graphite. Small ones, big ones, and your skin became impregnated with graphite. Another firm used to work for was so-called steelworks or ironworks, but they had nothing to melt. We used to dig in the floor to find old nails and bits of scrap metal. You could tell they were getting on right on the knees then, the Japanese, right on the knees. And there was another firm, I can't think of the name of it now, but mostly the lads that went there were from the Middlesex Regiment. And they had it all cut out. It handled lots of tins of salmon, thousands of tins of salmon and all sorts of foodstuff. Well, they used to. They had a table where they used to sit round and have their bowl of rice or whatever. And underneath they dug a big hole. And they put a wooden thing on top, put some sort of thing to hide it. And in the hole, they had this case of salmon. And when that was finished, they'd bring another one out, you know. And they got well in with the sentries. Some of the sentries were in on it. They would tell you when there was a good or a bad sentry on duty when they got back. And they used to get their cut, you know. I tried pinching something once. You know the shape of, a woman's sanitary towel, the old-fashioned one. I made a bag like that and filled it full of sugar. and tied it up around my crutch, tight. And this day, the wrong officer was on duty, and he felt all up around me, and he found it. He pulled me out, gave me a whack, whang, and made me stand for an hour with a dish of water above my head in front of the guard room, facing the guards. And if a fly got on your nose, you hadn't to twitch it. And you tried for 5 minutes holding a dish of water above your head. Well, before I learnt that lesson, I had a friend called Charlie Pegg, who come from the London area. I regret not informing his parents that I knew Charlie. He was trained to be an Anglican minister before the war. And Charlie was in a bad way. He had a room about this big, he set aside for the near dying. He had no beds to lie on, just on the floor. He had no medicines, just water. And he had two of our lads to keep an eye on them, you know. And one day I was in this big warehouse and I saw some jam. A tin of jam, big tins of jam, apricot jam. So I had a small tin with a screw top, and I filled it full of jam, and tied it up here on my arm, put a piece of string around there to hold it up. I thought, I'll take something for Charlie to give me urge to live, because a lot of our chaps, they died giving up the ghost. They literally gave up the ghost. They didn't want to live, they just switched off. And they died as if they'd been shot. And Charlie got in that stage, and I got back to the camp, and this chap was on. I shouldn't put the wrong time bringing it back. And he went up this leg, he went up that arm, and he went up this arm, and he stopped there. He stopped just there. If he'd got another 2 or 3 inches further, he'd have found it in a jam. I said, "Thank you, Lord, I won't do it again. You've let me off this time." I took it to Charlie after I had my bowl of rice, and I took it down to Charlie and I sat down beside him and I said, "Charlie, I brought you some jam for the taste of something Western food would." And Charlie just looked through me, you know, and he wasn't interested. And he said something to me which I've never forgot. Charlie was a Christian, as I was a Christian. I became a Christian in Hong Kong. And Charlie was a Christian, he was trained to be an Anglican clergyman, he's a real life sincere man. He said, "Albert, I'm going home." His mind wasn't wandering, it was at his faculties, but he said, "Albert, I'm going home." I know what he meant, he's going to heaven. So I left him, I knew he wouldn't taste the jam. And he went home that night. Poor lad, he went home that night, yeah. Poor Charlie Pegg. Poor Charlie Pegg.